surprise me. Never thought I'd see your face the way it used to be. Oh, darling. Oh, darling.
WMFO Medford, just about 10:02 in the morning. It's Mike on the mic here. Oh, such good sounds going on in the background. And you guys, you know, I just stacked up a couple of songs that I went down to pick up our in-studio guest, who I'll introduce in a second. But let me tell you what we played in that short set. The first one, The New Noise, was Albert Hammond Jr. From his latest, Francis Trouble. It's such a great album. And, you know, Set to Attack, it's just a great track. I played it last week, and I have to admit, it's been in my head as a really good earworm all week. So I hope you like that one. And then queued up a couple of long songs, quote unquote, because I had to get downstairs and walk up three flights of stairs and get everybody all set. But they were great. Stevie Ray Vaughan's Little Wing. Followed by Led Zeppelin and 10 Years Gone, of course. And it brings us to 10:02 in the morning with our in-studio guest, Mr. Tyler Morris. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me here.
You're welcome. Nice to see you. It happened kind of quick that you got in here. Thanks to Dave Riley for helping to get this to happen. And, you know, I have a lot of people that come in here that are local artists. And we talk about a lot of the same things, and we find a lot of common occurrences and common themes in people that are performers. But usually we talk about a certain amount of time where their careers have taken place. And it's the same with you, except with you, it's kind of a much reduced amount of time, just given when things and how fast things have happened to you. For people that don't know, Tyler is an old man of, what, about 20?
Yeah, 20 I just turned.
Yeah. I hate that. But in a good way, because, you know, I, among a lot of other people, are much older than that, and hopefully wiser. But you seem to have been able to figure out a lot of things in the span of about 14, 15 years. If I do the math quickly, you know, starting at around, and maybe you can explain this a little bit, maybe when you were around 6 years old or something, you started to realize that the music was important to you. I don't remember six. Do you remember six? And explain that.
I'm a little bit. So I didn't actually start really learning music until I was about 11.
Right, just an awareness, though.
But yeah, when I was six, so my dad was actually in a band that was at the house. That was a house band at the Hard Rock Cafe every week. So I would go to his rehearsals, and I would kind of strum the guitar, pretend like I was playing along to Beatles and Stones songs, and yeah, that's how I got aware of when I was about six.
I have to say, you know, your dad is here with us in the studio, and it's another common theme, to be honest with you. Many people say that it started in the home, either with, you know, mother or father or both, and that's like the best. What that did for you to have a dad who was into music and recognized that you were interested. You know, so around 6 years old, you started to tell us about how that happened. Was he playing? I mean, you said you went to some of those and you were aware of the shows he was playing. But what about the record collection at home? How about at home? There must have been music playing in the home, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was always music. Skinner, Aerosmith, you know, a lot of Eric Clapton, B.B. King stuff was playing. But I would go down. They would rehearse a lot of Stones and Beatles songs, actually. And I would go downstairs, and he would tune the guitar to an open chord, like an open D or something, mm-hmm. or an open G for Stone songs. And I would just strum along. You know, it would be in key because it was tuned to an open chord. But I thought I was, you know, really cool. Oh, I can
sure.
play. But really, at that time, I did not. I hadn't sat down yet and started learning.
But, you know, at that time, when did you and your dad and maybe the band realize that, okay, there's Tyler strumming on the guitar, but wait a minute, I'm starting to hear what he's doing. He's got something there. When did that happen?
One day I was actually home, I think it was a weekend or something, and I went through one of my dad's books and I learned some open chords and bar chords, and he came home and I kind of memorized all that stuff, and he came home and saw that I was playing that, and I think I was playing a little bit of, it was either Smoke on the Water or Secret Agent Man is something okay. that he would play a lot.
Yeah.
And then he's like, this is, you know, it's been one day, how do you, and I'm like, oh, well, I saw these books and then these other songs I saw you do in person.
That's what I was looking for, you know, somebody to say, how did you, wait a minute, you just, so Smoke on the Water doesn't surprise me. Everybody would air guitar that or whatever. Okay, so that's around 6, 7, 8. And when did you start to play with that? Not out, you know, but when did you start to play? When did your dad or the band say, hey, why don't you just see if, you know, you can play some rhythm and sit in?
So when I was around that was until I was around 11 that I started doing the open chord stuff.
Uh-huh.
And we started noticing. So by that time he actually had a different band, so I just was more jamming in the basement with him alone at that point. And then also I right off the bat, I started writing songs and writing, you know, my feelings into songs.
Yeah.
In the first few months of my playing, even though the ideas obviously weren't as developed as they are now or at a later date.
So as you started to do that, I know that there's a club that we know down in Hull called the C-Note. And so we started talking about when you were 8, 9, 10, 10, 10 or 11. Are you kidding me? So around then you started to play. Mm-hmm. How do you get in there, first of all, at that age? How do you start to play at the C-Note?
So the first time I ever got up on stage, it was at the C-Note, and was we were there to see Sam Gentile, because my grandparents have a place down there. And we, instead of jamming the house one day, my dad said, oh, let's go and, you know, see Sam. And we were talking to him during a set break. And he brought me up, you know, after, oh, want to play. And I think it was Throw Is Going or something. And he just told me, oh, we're going to do it standard in the key of B.
And did you feel ready? Was your heart pounding? Were you like, oh, my God, I'm going to go on stage? Or was it like, yeah, this is exactly what I want to do?
Well, yeah, at that time, I really wanted to do it. And I was comfortable playing lead. I was a less comfortable rhythm player, but Throw Is Going is actually something that I knew. So I knew all the... There's some tricky changes in the turnaround. And at that time, I did. It's one of the first songs I learned. So I didn't know that, and he had me up on stage, and I really kind of fell in love with the lead guitar playing and making vocal sounds from the guitar.
Ah, making vocal sounds. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. What about the concept of keys and being in tune with the band, and how did you deal with that? Were you used to that from seeing your father's band?
I was used to that. A lot of my practice early on was just jamming to backing tracks. So for me, it was kind of just I treat it as another practice session in the basement of my dad or, mm-hmm. or another jam. And I think early, I can't remember if it's, it must have been after the C-Note, but I did do some of that, like my elementary school talent shows and things like that, where I would play along to backing tracks. Sometimes the Throw Is Going and Tore Down.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff like that. So I had played that song before, so it was a good choice.
So the C-Note, not only did you first get on stage there, but you also experienced an audience and audience reactions, which I'm sure was like, whoa, this is fun. But also, you went back there quite often, I understand. And I'm sure that just the different kinds of music that you were exposed to and the different bands, I mean, there must have been, you know, just straight rock and roll, jazz, all sorts of things that you got to turn into a sponge, kind of.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And Coupled with, I was listening to everyone from George Benson to Freddie King to AC/DC at home too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when did you? So you started. You said you started to write your thoughts and stuff, but you really started to write at about what age?
I would say 12. I wrote my first two songs, which were actually on "And So It Begins."
Yeah, 12 yeah. was a big age. 12 was a big age. West Palm Beach.
Oh yeah.
And you know, let me talk a little bit about the concept of the word luck. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that anybody's lucky, because people argue all the time, does luck exist? Is it a thing? I kind of think it's a thing, but it has to have a couple of other elements, right? I mean, you have to, like, quote, be in the right place at the right time. But anything that goes along with being lucky, quote unquote, it doesn't matter if you don't have it, if you don't have the stuff. And you have the stuff. So when did you... Did you ever feel lucky, I guess, or did you just realize that, you know what, I've been listening to music like this since I was six, and I got to go on stage at the C-Note, and I've been listening to all this music, and I'm ready, you know, this is just my destiny? Or did you feel like, oh my God, all this stuff is happening to me, how am I so lucky, if that makes any sense?
Well, a combination of both things. I felt like I was ready to perform, but also the music industry, I feel, is such a tight net. It's such a small industry of people knowing other people that I felt like I ran into some luck. As you're referring to in West Palm Beach when I sat in with B.B. King's band, that how that happened.
And talk about how that happened, because I said right place at the right time. Right? Talk about that story.
I was in a guitar center.
Yeah.
Just doing, I think my dad was doing the same jam thing. We were jamming on some blues songs in guitar center on vacation. And Gary King, who's the leader of BB's band, he was in Luther Vandross's band, walks in and invited us to his show that night.
Just as a spectator?
Just as a spectator in BB King's West Palm Beach. And I was in the bathroom, and we ran to him, and he said, "Hey, wanna, I heard you're doing Throw Is Gone. Wanna come up and sit in?" And actually, that video is on YouTube. It's on someone's channel. I found it, I think, a few times. But actually, the other thing is the sound guy at BB King's in West Palm is Donald Duck Dunn's son as well. So that was really cool. But yeah, that was a. I would say
that was a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal running into him, and definitely a lot of luck.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what a place to be able to play, mm-hmm. And you met the man.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I met him. That night BB wasn't playing with them. That was just the BB King All Star Band.
Uh huh.
But I did meet BB that summer, in Howell, Massachusetts. Actually, a day after I played at the C-Note again.
And did that come about because of your being at the West Palm Beach Club? Was he told about you, and he looked for you at that? He knew you were going to be there, or was it, again, just a lucky happenstance?
That was a lucky happening. I'm not sure if Gary told him about me. It's quite possible.
I bet he did.
Probably. And then the video online as well. But we were actually eating breakfast the day after I played at the C-Note again that summer in Hull. And we went to, there's a local hotel, and we just went there. And it happened that BB had been playing the night before at South Shore. And at that time he was in a wheelchair, so they wheeled him out. But he was very nice, shook my hand, took a picture, gave us, he had these tour necklaces that were like gold, and I still have those. I have a collection of
sure.
all the picks and stuff.
Sure. Okay, so you know, now you're kind of on your way, and you're starting to think about writing, and you're probably around 13, and I don't know if you started to think about, you know, maybe I might want to put some stuff down in the studio and want to release a record. But for the first record, just sort of talking about everything that we've mentioned and all the influences, I asked you, as I do most people that first come here, to talk about their influences and, like, who it was back then and even now that, you know, put the goosebumps on you, and it's like they've made you realize that you had to do this. So you gave me a couple of different ideas and a couple of different songs. Aerosmith, of course, Boston Boy.
Oh, yeah.
Albert King and Van Halen. I want to play those three, but let's talk a little bit about them and the meaning to you from the perspective of back then, like when you first heard that, and even now, because when I asked you the question, who are your influences, those are the three. Why are those three, and why did they make you realize that this is what you want to do?
So I started out listening to Aerosmith, Clapton, AC/DC,
mm-hmm.
essentially.
But you really got into it. I mean, you didn't just listen.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I got it. You know, I was learning with a lot of those three artists. I learned their whole catalogs, and all the blues and rock stuff, I learned by ear. I didn't use any notation because I find that the notation a lot, it's everyone's ear, and everyone hears differently, so the notation
your ear
isn't
is
necessarily
unique to you.
The right position. And so I dove into those, and after that kind of phase, I started getting into the Van Halen, a little more hard rock, but still blues-influenced music, and then I was in the Van Halen kind of world for a while, but still with the Clapton and still rooted in the blues kind of acts, and eventually, after going to a number of bands, Deep Purple, I went back and got more into that initial Aerosmith and stuff, but the 70s stuff that was really rooted in the blues and later the 90s as well and stuff. But as I would say, as a younger age with Aerosmith, I was focused on the early catalog, where now I kind of see them as a their 40-year progression as songwriters, and those guys are incredible. Steven.
Sure, and I would think that you would realize, being a blues person, the relationship that's always there between blues and rock and roll. One couldn't exist without the other.
Oh yeah, and they cover a ton of those.
Sure did.
As well as Van Halen. Rufus Thomas's "Walking the Dog" is one that we play a lot, and even a lot like Guns N' Roses covered that too, and hearing that influence as well.
And also, you know, before we play, there's a constant in all of those artists that you mentioned, and all of those genres, and all those songs, is the electric guitar. You know, that's the constant. You know, it spans different genres, doesn't it? But it's still, you know, it's the thing that just got you.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sure you concentrate. I mean, I know that you and I have talked a little bit about vocal range, you know, Steven Tyler, even Steve Perry, you know, maybe Axl. I don't know. We didn't talk about Axl. But, you know, guitar. So let's have a listen to these three influences with the perspective of the music, rock and roll, and blues sort of being inseparable, and just the electric guitar. First one is by Aerosmith, it's Walking the Dog, and we'll go through Albert King, Oh Pretty Woman, not more woman than one, just one woman, and Van Halen, and Little Dreamer. This is WMFO, these are Tyler's influences here. Enjoy, everybody.
Just paint and powder ain't gonna help you, darling, cause you're a pretty woman right down to the bone. So you just might as well still leave your skin alone. Oh, pretty woman, what you try to do? You kept on fooling around till I got stuck on you. So you just drop that mess and come down off your throne. Stop using my poor heart for just a stepping stone. Pretty woman, what's the matter with you? Can't make you love me, no matter what I do. That's all right for you. Now you just go on doing what you wanna do. But someday when you think that you have got it made, you can't help what a deep in love, so you can't wait. Pretty woman, what's the matter with you? Can't make you love me, yeah, no matter what I do.
WMFO, Medford. 10:27 in the morning. Mike and Tyler here. We're just off of hearing a couple of his influences. You know, all very much guitar focused. Very different guitarists, though. I mean, you know, Tyler, what do you think? Just quickly, you know, Joe Perry, Albert King, and Eddie. You know, I mean, Eddie sort of is rightfully known for inventing a way to play.
Oh yeah.
What are your thoughts on those three, and who you most sort of look up to and emulate if you do?
They all know how to groove, and they all have rhythm. And I think that's what not only attracts the guitar audience, but it attracts pop listeners. It attracts everyone, and all three of those artists had successful Billboard hits. In addition to just being they can do great guitar solos and things like that, they're also great songwriters.
Important point. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you're going to be an artist that covers other artists, that's one thing. But if you can have your own stuff and run with your own stuff, and that's the path that you chose. Mm-hmm. And you gave me a great segue into your first record. You know, what were you about? I mean, I know you started. You said you started to write when you were around 13, but did your first record come out when you were around 15?
Yeah, I think it was 15. It was 2015, I believe, when it came out.
And So It Begins. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand the title.
Yeah, so but I remember in the recording process, I actually finished the last recording on my 15th birthday, so I do remember that.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, you know, when somebody would put out their first record, it goes out and it goes out into the ether. That didn't happen to you. You got a lot of press, specifically in guitar magazines, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So, you know, what was that like? Explain how that was like being you and seeing all of that come out of just your first release.
Oh yeah, that was great. We're in Korea Guitar Player, Guitar World, Vintage Guitar, and I mean it was mind-boggling because I mean I was like, there I was, a reader of Guitar Player, and the next month I'm in the magazine, and I have a 3-page article on myself, and it's a picture of me jamming with Steve Vai.
So when that stuff came out, how aware were you? How ready for you? Did you know that stuff was going to come out? Did the phone start ringing? Did you know?
Yeah, because so how it generally works is, if they're going to do a review or an interview with you in one of these magazines, they do it probably 6 months in advance, where they do it either
in advance of the record coming out,
email. They should do it in 6 months.
Yeah,
advance,
but it was your first record, always, right?
Yeah, it doesn't always work that way. They do it in advance of the article, so I know the article is going to come out. But in the case with the first record, we didn't start getting press till maybe 6 to 8 months after, once people had some time to listen and listen to the songwriting. It was on a lot of online outlets, I think. I had a lot of success with it. In addition to, we sold... I feel like you sell the most physical CDs live instead of online.
Oh, that makes sense. And it makes sense, too, that, you know, the reaction would have been after people had a chance to take it in. But just wondering, you know, that I keep harping on it, but your first record, and yeah, you know, you had some experiences with meeting some great guitar players and playing out, but your first record, all of a sudden, you're getting all this press, and like you said, there you are with a spread in a guitar magazine that you read. In a sentence or two, what was it like? Did you freak out is what I'm looking for?
Yeah, I was, I freaked out. to this day, I save photos of everything. I'm in PDFs of everything that I'm in. Hmm. And I have it right here on my phone, actually, where I have albums of tens of thousands of press clippings, Facebook posts, because I can't believe that, you know, I'll see something from Gibson or Dean or like one of these companies, and they're posting me,
right,
and talking about me. So I just take a photo and, you know, and I save all that stuff. Because to this day, I still can't believe a lot of the stuff that comes out.
Mm-hmm. And your next record didn't take long. You know, that was within a year or a year and a half,
I
guess.
Yeah, about a year after.
And during that year, I mean, did some of those songs come from, I'll just say, from the first album sessions, or were they all new?
They were all new, but I had been writing the second album during the first album. and the first album material I had from just years before.
So you had plenty of material in your gray matter.
Oh yeah, like on my computer now I have hundreds of songs, and I mean there's probably about 34 that are really there. I counted the other day that
you got to whittle them down
for,
though.
For net, and I only do 10 songs a record, so they keep building up. So you have to you have to pick the best ones, but also I've thought about doing different styles of records too, where I could categorize the songs, and then that way I can do multiple releases a year. But I can do them in not like one the blues world, one the rock world, and then any other genre that I have songs for.
Mm-hmm. So the chaos continues in your second record, and I suppose that whatever kind of crazy press and recognition was going on just grew. At that point, mm-hmm. Can you remember any particular experiences where people reached out to you and you know, just things that blew you away? For because sometimes a sophomore release is not a good experience. Mm-hmm. Wasn't the case. It was good.
Yeah. So actually, Vintage Guitar Magazine, that time they asked me to do an exclusive video for them, and I actually did one. Lonnie Mack had passed away, so I did mm-hmm. one on how he's a big influence to me. And since then, they've had me do, I become an online contributor. So I've done 10, 20, 50 videos for, I could count them. And I do them about every month. Vintage Guitar has me do videos. And that really, I would say, upped the pressing and stuff. And that happened as a result of they liked the second record that they asked me to do that.
And that, just for people who don't know, that's just you sitting there with their guitars that they're showing off, mm-hmm. and you play them, and you are the demonstrator in chief.
Right? Yeah, they asked me, like, I did a Van Halen tribute video, and some of the Van Halen stuff seems to get a lot of views, because I've done Joe Perry, I think 150,000, but the Van Halen one got 250-something thousand views. And well, I mean, the Joe Perry one was also helped because Aerosmith shared it on their page, which was, again, another...
Right, like, whoa.
I can't believe that, so I got 50 screenshots dedicated to that.
Yep. So, okay, so all of that's happening. You're being requested to do all sorts of things. And were you playing out a lot, you know, after the second record?
Yeah, in the second record, I really started to craft a live show, and I was doing a lot of singing with other artists and playing with them, collaborating, as well as I had some incarnations of an early band that we played out a little bit, and then at trade shows, at the NAMM show and stuff, Fishman and Dean Guitars and stuff would have me do... I have everything in backing tracks from the first two records in case I have to demonstrate and stuff.
Yeah, cool. So it took a little while between the second and the third record, which is your latest, that we want to hear some stuff from. So what would you say, it was like 3 years, right?
Yeah.
So why 3 years? How do you think your attitude towards recording changed, and how does the finished product difference now in the third record from the second? Because, you know, from what was it, 15 years old to whatever, or 16 to 19, whatever it was, you know, a person changes a lot. So what was that like, and how were you able to settle on, yeah, I'm happy with this third record?
So I had been going into a lot of the blues world again, but this time I was going into deeper guys like Lonnie Mack. I got more into Albert King and Freddie King instead of just BB and Clapton.
Mm-hmm.
And I really got into the influences that these guys were influenced by, T-Bone Walker. And that really, I was on this whole kind of, and I still am, this whole journey with the how the blues is connected to other genres and how we were mentioning
it
earlier.
Is, yeah.
And I had begun incorporating that stuff in my style. And, you know, I was ready to do a record, so we did the next in line. I basically had so many songs between that time that we picked the very best and the most ones that would get across this love of the blues, but still with my own spin on it, some unique. And actually, what's interesting is that recording Next in Line took While the other records took a few months, I recorded that album in 3 days.
Okay, I didn't expect you to say that, actually. I thought it would be the other way around.
And that I did that because I had a conversation with Brad Whitford from Aerosmith.
Yep.
And he was telling me that he's like, we did the early records. We did them in 3 days. You rehearse one day, and the other 2 days you record rhythm the first day, and the other 2 days you track the guitar parts and vocal parts, and that, you know, we record every Aerosmith record that way. And he's like, that's how I would do a record today.
It's another question for you. How do you handle the recording instrumentation? Do you do it separately? Do you separate the every instrument? Do you record live? Some people swear by that. You know, what do you do?
Well, see, on the first two records, we took our time and we did. I played a lot of the instruments like bass and synthesizer and pretty much everything except for drums. So you had to separate it, and it took more time because of that, because you can't have two or three of you in the same room.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about how'd you put together the band, but there's the answer.
Yeah, so yeah. I wanted to do it more, since I was going this rock, classic rock, blues direction, I wanted to, from that advice from Brad, I wanted to do it real old school. So I got Scott Spray from Johnny Winter and Rick Derringer's band, and Tiger McNeil, who plays with Jose Feliciano's. And it was just us three in a room. The first day we record every song live. And the next 2 days, I just did guitar tracks. And then the vocalist, who's in Norway, Morten Friedheim, did his tracks from his studio. And Joe Lewis Walker also came in the last day and tracked.
Yeah, he was on Willie the Wimp. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so so you were 18, 19 years old doing this. And there you are, you know, ripping off all of these people that you're working with. Yeah, so, okay, here we are, and the new record is out. You brought your guitar here. I wonder if you would just sort of demonstrate for us a little bit your technique, because it is unique. And I find it pretty cool that you don't get jaded by all of the influences that you have, and you're able to sort of figure out who you are and how you play. So we had talked about you're doing a little bit of a look at some of the records that, I mean, the tracks that are on your record, little pieces of them. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
okay.
I'll play a little bit.
We'll be right back.
Okay, so cool. Those are pieces of some of the tracks on your latest record.
Yeah, those are a few riffs. I played a little bit of "This Ain't No Fun" and a lot of an instrumental track called "Choppin'," which is kind of a B.B. King big band swing.
Yep.
Tune, and obviously there's a lot of blues-based improvisation that I did, and this is kind of I'm just here with me and a guitar and a small amp, and yep. It's kind of. That's a little taste of how I come up with these ideas and what I do in the studio to jam when I'm, you know, not with a band, a full band. And it's kind of, when I sit around the house, it's, you know, I do that those fun things where I'll change a groove or I'll start soloing. It'll take the song in a different direction. And that's how I came up with a lot of these particular songs on this last album.
Mm-hmm. And that last album is out now. Mm-hmm. It just came out earlier this year?
Yeah, it's, I believe, February 2nd through Viz Tone Label Group and Red Eye Distribution, which it's on CD, and I just got... Red Eye just sent me another order for a bunch of vinyls.
Okay.
We have special limited edition red vinyl. And I'm a huge vinyl collector, but that to have it's great to have a limited edition color vinyl. But I really think it makes the sound slightly better from a listener's standpoint. And to me, if I were to get if I were to buy a product like a physical CD or vinyl, I would get the vinyl and then get the digital download because it's something you can display.
Okay, absolutely. I mean, as you can see, we have quite a few records here, vinyl, for sure. So we're definitely fans of vinyl, and we have, you know, a couple turntables, and we use them as often as we can. But talk a little bit about the label, the Viztone label that your record's out on, and Bob Margolin, the legendary Bob Margolin, who is a founder of that label, and with whom you're going to be playing. We'll talk about that a little bit, too. But Viztone label.
Yeah, so... What happened was I had the record made, and I was debating about releasing it on my own label as I did the first two.
Mm-hmm.
But I got what happened was Bob Margolin heard the record, and so did Rosie Rosenblatt, who actually lives pretty locally to me. He plays in Danny Klein's band, and he's probably my favorite harmonica player. He's just a great player. But him and Bob... started Viztone Label Group in about 2005, and Rosie actually is the original founder of Tone Cool Records before that,
mm-hmm.
Which is just the continuation of it, but they got Susan Tedeschi, her first gold record, and they had North Mississippi All-Stars, they had Mike Welsh, a bunch of acts on there, so basically Bob and Rosie heard this record when we were trying to figure out who's going to release it, who's going to distribute it. And I got contacted from Rosie, and he said, hey, we really like this record. Could we release it on our label? And I was going in that blues direction. And they have a lot. They have Amanda Fish, Bob. They have a ton of Heather Newman.
Blues artists, yeah.
A ton of blues artists, and even... a little bit blues rock, but they really liked that my style was a bit more edgy in a blues sense, but for classic rock it's a bit soft, I would say. So they liked that it was something different, and it's been a great experience working with them, and Amy Bratt's the publicist for label too, and she's just great as well.
Okay, so you're going to be playing out. You've got a couple of things planned. The first of which is coming up a week from Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. October 21st. It's called Tune In and Tune Up All Stars Show at the Met in Pawtucket. That one's going to be cool. What's the band going to be like there?
Yeah, so we got an all-star band.
It's like everybody.
Most of the all-star band is in John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band. We get Gary Gramolini, Dean Castell, and Don Culp. And then, of course, John Cafferty will be joining us for a few songs.
Singing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He'll be singing, and he plays guitar as well. And we also got James Montgomery. We got Steve Smith. Steve Smith and the Nakeds, who was also featured on Family Guy, which is a cool fact. Myself, I'm bringing my vocalist, Craig Rodding, as well. Steve Malik, and there's some surprise people as well, and also some surprise renditions that like I'll be doing certain stuff with other artists that I've never done before. So that's October 21st at the Met, and we actually have an open rehearsal this Sunday as well.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So that's an all ages show, as all the shows we're talking about are, and that's an afternoon show too. That's at 2 p.m. So again, October 21st, it's a Sunday, I think, in Pawtucket. And then Bob Margolin, he's going to be, his leg of his tour is coming around here, and you're going to be there for three shows in a row.
Yes,
with him.
So we, Bob and I have our own collaboration. It's a co-headline collaboration called Bob Margolin, Tyler Morris, and Friends.
Mm-hmm.
And we bring Rosie as well, because he just adds a ton to everything, and we bring Don Kalb, Craig Rawing. So it's basically my band plus Bob and Rosie, and we did that in June at a few venues, and we sold out. It was very successful, so we've been asked to come around again, and we're doing a quick three-run date. Mm-hmm. And then I assume we'll be back next spring too, and Bob and I are trying to bring the collaboration to some other states and festivals and things like that as well.
And you and Bob are going to be with me sort of over the phone line next month,
definitely.
Just sort of around those dates. And let me tell everybody when the dates were, or not were, they haven't happened yet, Mike. It's November 16th, 17th, and 18th. On the 16th, it's in Hartford, Connecticut at Black Eyed Sally's. It's an 8 o'clock all-ages show. The 17th is at Thunder Road right here in Somerville, 8 o'clock all-ages show. And the 18th is at Nelson's Candies. That sounds delicious.
Oh, yeah.
Wilton, New Hampshire, all-ages, 8 o'clock. It's all you and Bob, right? Oh, we have a dad conversation sidebar.
For those who don't know, Bob Margolin was in the movie The Last Waltz.
That's
and was
right.
Muddy Waters' guitar player for 20 years.
That's
so
right.
It's an honor when Ronnie Earl sits in with us and he says, "Bob taught me everything. You should be honored to work with this man," which I am. But Bob is just one of these guys, as is Ronnie, where he's texting you. He always texts stuff like, "Oh, can I be helpful for any advice at all?" And you just don't even you just think of him as another human being. And then you speak to him, and he says, "Oh, Eric Clapton just texted me this photo. Check it out." And it's just like, wow.
Right.
The
blows your mind.
I can't believe I'm working with
you know, and Bob, you know, in his early days, you know, his the whole thing with Muddy Waters and him getting to learn from playing with Muddy Waters all those years, it's just crazy. So you get to play with him in November.
And he picked up I would say more than anyone else I've seen for Muddy. When he sings the stuff, it's like Muddy's in the room. It's incredible.
Okay. Well, why don't we hear some of your record? You picked a couple of songs from there where, of course, time is my enemy, so we're running out of time. So let's start with something from the new record, which just came out. And the first one you picked is Thunder. You said it's your favorite. Why is it your favorite?
This is my take on like a Joe Perry kind of groovy riff. And I really dig that style because it's the culmination of blues and rock.
Okay, we're going to play a couple songs from this record, and we'll be back right after that, and we'll say goodbye at that point. But turn it up, everybody. Enjoy from Tyler's new record called Next in Line. This is Thunder, WMFO.